irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is another Thursday night in beautiful downtown Sherman Oaks, California. My name is Jim Christina. I am the host of The Writer's Block, and you are listening to LA Talk Radio. I'm in studio with Bobby Jean Bell, who is back in town finally.
I'm back from being out Chicago way.
She was out in Chicago, and she just, now she got back. When did you get back?
Actually, late yesterday.
Oh, jeez.
And you know, the drive home from LAX took almost as much time as in the air from Chicago to LAX.
I don't doubt that a bit. That's why I fly into Burbank.
Well, we could get a direct. There were reasons to fly out of LAX, but yeah.
Yeah. We got a pretty busy show tonight, so let's just get right into it. Hi, Jim. How are you? So anyway, the Writer's Block is brought to you now by Tuscany Bay Books and Black Dog Publishing. Tuscany Bay and Black Dog, if you're an indie writer or someone who is wanting to get a book published, please give us a call. That's what we're around for. We can help you format. We can help you edit, proofread, bind, get them published, did everything you need. It's a one-stop shop for you new writers out there. It's Black Dog Publishing, and it's Tuscany Bay Books. We have our brand new book, our very first book out through Tuscany Bay, is called Jonah Blue. It just hit the market today, and we're looking for some good sales on that. So if you're interested, that's available on Amazon and all of the online booksellers, plus from Tuscany Bay and Black Dog's website, plus the website of Out West. And of course, The Writer's Block is brought to you also by Out West, your online source for top brands that are a reflection of the equestrian and western lifestyle. Shop for unique and distinctive apparel, boots, hats, fashion accessories, home decor, books, music, and general merchandise. I can tell you wrote this. National brands include the Scully Leather Company, Rock Mount Ranchwear, Dan Post Boots, and American West Handbags, just to name a few. Their number, toll-free, is 877-340-9378. And if you're looking to get a ticket for their concert series, which is the fourth Friday of every month, that direct line is 661-347-9700. And, of course, as always, The Writer's Block is brought to you by Target Freight Management.
Since 2009, Target Freight has had a full truckload service, TFM Truckload, that's the best in the industry. Not only are they exceptionally good at what they do, but they strive to make your full truckload shipping experience unparalleled. Call TFM Truckload today at 1-844-653-7789. Ask for Mike Matruski and tell him you heard it on The Writer's Block, and TFM will have a little something extra for you. If you are an LTL shipper, getting your freight moved your way the most expedient way possible is what you want. One-stop shop, no hassle. Call Target Freight Management today. Their customized traffic movement program is the finest in the industry. So call at 1-888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com on the web for both truckload and LTL. Call today.
Oh, thank you.
We're back.
You caught me unawares. I was reading. I have a faux pas that I have to correct tonight, so I'm going to do it right now. Last week, I was supposed to mention this, and I didn't, and I got slapped when I got home, and I got slapped by the author, and
aww.
I got slapped by just about everybody. So let me do that right now. We have coming up some real relevant authors that have been on the show before that are booked again for this year. A couple of them are very well known. One of them is Craig Johnson, who is, of course, is the originator of the Longmire series. He will be on with us on August 24th. We have Mike Bond, who has written a 9,000-page tome called The Assassins.
The Assassins is really good.
I just started it, and it's spellbinding.
Yes.
And it's got big print. Yay, Mike.
Yay.
And I was neglectful to mention last week, Rochelle Wisoff Fields, who has got a new coffee table book coming out of her art. She is one hell of an artist.
Yes, she is.
If you happen to be a friend of hers on Facebook, you can go see some of her art there. And she will have a whole book of it coming out. I think that's going to be one of her reasons for calling in on September 7th, is that her book has been delayed. So, Rochelle, if you feel like calling in, you can call in whenever you want. Let's get that book out. I'm sure people will want to see it because your art is so, so good. Tonight, the question I asked myself, and I asked you a little earlier, what do you do when you have, you know, you run a multi-million, multi-billion dollar company, you're on the board of trustees at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? What do you do beyond that? You write a book.
I think you write a book.
Tonight's guest got his start in the early days of garage bands. He's also an executive of a leading global company. We don't know which one. Well, I think we may ask him that. He holds a seat on the board of trustees of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He has written a book about the 27 Club, or whatever.
The myth of the 27,
about all the rock stars that died at 27 years old. The book is entitled Bright Midnight. It takes in Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Brian Jones, Jim Morrison. Golly, just to name a few. All died at an early age, all connected to the music of the 1960s and early 70s. Chris Foreman is the author. Chris's novel creatively proposes new evidence and cracks open a shocking story that delivers a gut punch to the music industry. This is a book that's kind of been called the Da Vinci Code of rock and roll. So without much further ado, can we welcome to the Writer's Block Mr. Chris Foreman. Chris, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I am. Hey, guys.
Hey, guy. What do you say?
Welcome.
Hey, how are you?
We're excellent. As I told you earlier, we have read your book, and I opened it and I thought, holy crap, what small print! But then I couldn't put it down. So
you can enlarge.
That's age.
You can enlarge the font. You know, that's the one good thing about electronic reading.
Thank God I have reading glasses. I never would have made it.
Well, I know we couldn't put this book down, Chris. So thank you for writing it. Can you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write Bright Midnight?
Just a little of the backstory you've got going on here.
Yeah, I'll tell you. It really started maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I collect rock and roll memorabilia. You know, I'm involved with the Rock Hall,
sure.
So you know why not? But I collect rock and roll memorabilia, and I had one evening I was walking through my gallery. I've got a little rock memorabilia gallery, and I was admiring the latest edition. In my gallery, it was a 2-page article from a newspaper called the Record Mirror from 1964. It was a London paper. It was sort of like the Jazz Standard or Variety of London at the time. But the Record Mirror from 1964 announcing a hot new band called the Rolling Stones. And what struck me the most was, you know, not that it was about the Stones, but how young they were. You know, Keith Richards, sort of this fresh-faced Keith Richards, you know, not a line in his face. Sort of a pimply Mick Jagger, and Brian Jones, who was the founder of the Rolling Stones. And while I was admiring it, you know, right next to them, I had some Jimi Hendrix and then some Jim Morrison memorabilia. And it struck me that, you know, these guys had all died at 27. There was an old hippie myth, Club of 27, Myth of 27. So that's been around for a long time. And a lot of you know, sort of cocktail speculation about what would happen, and urban legends and conspiracy theories just swirled around their deaths for 40 or 50 years. But at that time, I got in my head the idea that I couldn't shake, you know, for days and days. You know, what if they didn't die by accident or overdoses or misadventure, as it was called? What if they were murdered? And that was the kernel of the idea for Bright Midnight. Bright Midnight's a fictional murder mystery that reimagines the deaths of a number of iconic late 60s and 70s rock stars, not as accidents, but as murders. It's not a history book. It's not an expose, but it's a fictional, sort of a cold case murder investigation, a fictional murder investigation that takes place today, going back with evidence and insights over the last 50 years. So that's how it came about.
It's so fun because you said it, like you say, it's kind of going in contemporary times, but then we go back and we unpeel the layers because our main character is 65 and he's a veteran writer for Rolling Stone magazine. Tell us a little bit about this wonderful character that you've created, Gantry Elliott.
I really liked him.
Liked him. And he wore cowboy boots, Jim. Did you?
We all see a lot of ourselves. And Gantry Elliott, you know, I wanted someone that could kind of fit the part. And, you know, it was helpful to me for some of the characters to sort of picture who they might be. So if you remember... remember the movie Crazy Heart with Jeff Bridges?
Oh, sure.
Sure.
Remember the movie? Okay, remember Jeff Bridges and that? Gantry Elliott, to me, looked like Jeff Bridges, but not as scraggly and, you know, not a drunk. But he looked like Jeff Bridges, but he had the personality of a well-known writer who worked for Rolling Stone years ago and then was an investigative reporter for 60 Minutes for Mike Wallace for a while, named Jerry Hopkins. You remember the name Jerry Hopkins? He actually wrote a book called No One Gets Out Alive.
Oh yeah.
That was about the Doors.
Okay.
And Jim Morrison. So, you know, so he had sort of this he had the Jeff Bridges look, you know, sort of a scruffy Texas, you know, kind of look. But with the personality and drive of a Jerry Hopkins, who actually worked for Rolling Stone, was one of the original writers for Rolling Stone. So that was sort of the idea, and you know, I wanted someone who would have been around, sort of a contemporary, who knew some of these people and knew the music and the environment firsthand, and could be. Because it's important, the book that he carries with him, this encyclopedic knowledge of the era, the people, the environment, the music, everybody that they hung around with.
And he has a wonderful, I'm going to say, kind of love for each one of them. We get to see, you know, that Jim Morrison's really influenced by poetry and classical literature. I mean, he brings... You know, he portrays Janis Joplin. Wow, it's really great. All the scenes with Janis Joplin. You know, he brings them to life for us, especially if all we know of them is kind of a name. We can remember a song or two, but we never got to know them as our heroes. Mm-hmm. He really writes about them, and he goes back to his files.
Yeah,
you know, he goes back to his files. He's very organized, and he's got that one file, the dead. What is he?
He's got the dead star file, the dead rock star files.
Yeah, the dead rock star.
Yeah, but it becomes very important in the investigation because he's got all these great notes and articles and memories that he, you know, that he'd been collecting. So And then the FBI.
One of the things, Bobby, just stop you there for that. One of the things that I tried to do. You know, was because, you know, unless you grew up in that era, you didn't really know, you know, all these rock stars have been sort of characterized, you know, over the years. And, you know, they come across as like drug-addled hippies, you know. And so you just see like the worst caricatures of them. But some of them were, what I tried to, you know, bring out in some of the little vignettes was their real personalities and what they were like. I mean, Jim Morrison was a genius. You know, Jimi Hendrix was a perfectionist, absolute perfectionist, and a jokester. And these guys had, they were all brilliant in their own way and creative, but you never really read about that. You just read about, you know, they took drugs and they were drunk and they did, you know, crazy things.
The cut that you talk about Jimi Hendrix and Brian Jones did, what's the name of that?
Mm-hmm.
My
My little one.
I actually brought that up and listened to it. It was very interesting. It really is. I mean, it's really kind of different because you have guitar, you have sitar, harmonica. You got just about everything in there.
I stumbled upon it by accident when I was looking for ties between the different people to see if there were some, you know, correlation, and I stumbled upon it, and then. And I mentioned in the book, you know, where Ganser says, well, you really, it's hard to get this. You know, sometimes it was on there, sometimes it was taken off. That happened to me. I went on, and then I went on a couple weeks later, and I couldn't find it again.
Ah.
And then I found it going back. And, you know, it's, there are a couple versions. It was never published, you know, you know, there are a couple versions of it, and it's kind of cool. And
yeah,
they were talking about forming their own group at the time.
And so what stopped them? Death?
Death.
incidentally.
That would be a motive.
Yeah, if you want to call and talk to Chris Formant, who's on the phone with us now, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Again, that's 818-602-4929. You can come right in here, and I'll answer the phone, and you can talk directly to Chris, and he can just fill you all in on what's going on in this book. And it's fascinating.
It's really fun. And, of course, we don't want to do a lot of spoiler alerts, because we really want y'all to read this book. You also have a wonderful agent with the FBI, and you do introduce some really high-tech forensics. It sort of reminds me of episodes from Bones and other things where they're working with these 3D. Can you tell us a little bit about the research that you did? I mean, are some of these... is this currently ways that forensics research can be done, or did you imagine some of this really high?
Yes.
Or do we have? Can you not tell us, because we'd have to kill you?
I'll tell you what I did. I'll tell you how I sort of got. You know, I was put in touch. You know, got in touch with some former FBI and NYPD investigators, and they gave me some insight into forensic techniques and modern cold case investigative techniques, and actually turned me on to a couple sources and some of the textbooks that they use at the FBI. And so I actually studied forensic techniques to sort of come up with plausible approaches, you know, to it. And I also had one of the top neurosurgeons and researchers from Johns Hopkins Medicine, who helped me interpret the autopsies, and then where they had autopsies. Now, a lot of them didn't have autopsies at all, and suggested, sort of brainstormed with them about alternative ways that the stars could have died, either physically or chemically. And you know, when that started sort of the reimagining process. So, you know, when I went back and sort of applied sort of modern, sophisticated forensic practices, they really didn't have a whole lot of DNA. They really didn't have a whole lot of evidence. You know, a lot of those, in some cases, there was nothing, you know, no witnesses, and nothing left. And so in order to try to bridge that, even the latest technology couldn't bridge it. I'm a technologist by trade, and so I created some new technologies, you know, that are not in existence today.
Yet.
Probably sound like it. They probably slip right by you. But they, at least when I wrote the book, they were non-existent.
They will be now.
I don't want to be a spoiler, but there are two. There's one that is a digital fabric analysis that through photos or photo analytics you can determine what kind of fabric it is. Mm-hmm. Now, you've seen in CSI or some of the crime shows, they might have a little piece of thread, and then they can identify where it came from, but they physically have the thread. And so, you know, I posited that, well, what if you could at some point you do that digitally? Mm-hmm. Well, there wasn't anything around that could do it digitally, but I figured, well, the way things are going, mm-hmm. that'll probably happen in the mm-hmm. future. Mm-hmm. So that technique there where they, and I won't go too much further,
right.
where they,
I think, off of a photo, yeah, we got
they can identify, yeah, yeah. You get, so they can identify that. So, the other was a virtual crime scene mm-hmm. Simulator that created a life-size holographic yeah. murder scenes from the original crime scene yeah. photos. Yeah. Those, that doesn't exist today.
I'm sure that's being worked on.
There's nothing
on.
Like that.
That has to be being worked on.
Well, you know, it amazes me that you
Well, it sounds like it does.
It does. It does.
You know, really, well, like now let's look at the digital replay. What digital replay? But yeah. I mean, the technologists today, I mean, if you don't have it, just make it up.
Now,
well, that's kind of what I did.
Now, to me, although I know the book is fiction, it really felt so very believable, just as I felt as I read mm-hmm. The Da Vinci Code. And I know this book is kind of being referred to as The Da Vinci Code for rock and roll. But you have me totally convinced that these performers all met untimely demises, not by their own hand or by their habits. How do you feel, you know, do you feel that too? Did you feel more and more confident about that as you were writing, or do you, you know, where do you?
Well, I did. When I first went into it, I didn't think that at all. I mean, I just thought, oh, this is an old hippie myth, and, you know, there's not a whole lot to it. And but I thought it would be a good rationale for a murder mystery, for a cold case murder mystery. And, you know, it was around all these people that everybody's heard the stories, and these are all very famous, you know, artists. So I thought it would be kind of fun to come up with an alternative reality, you know. But when I started to get into it and started to really study what had happened and how some of this was really atrociously handled, mm-hmm. atrociously poorly, and when you think back in that era, and I mean, you guys you know, may be able to relate to it firsthand, you know, that you know, these were enemies of the state,
mm-hmm. right?
So they were
mm-hmm.
being set up, they were being arrested, you know all the time, and so harassed continually, you know. And so, you know, it made sense that they would be handled pretty poorly. But when I started really looking into it, you know, a couple of them stood out as really they were so flimsily done, and where they had autopsies, they didn't make any sense, and there was such controversy around them. Two of them certainly felt like you know, it's possible that they could have it wasn't an overdose, or, you know, wasn't an accident. You know, the first, Brian Jones, really sounds mm-hmm. I'm very skeptical mm-hmm. on that, and there's been a lot of controversy swirling around that one. And when you look at the motivations and everything, here's a guy that founded the Rolling Stones. It was his name. I mean, he owned the rights to it. And then he was kicked out of the group, and then 30 days later, and apparently there's a lot of, you know, animosity at the time swirling around it. He's kicked out of the group that he owned the rights to and that he founded. He was sort of the creative inspiration for, and used to be the creative director and manager, everything else. And so he's kicked out of the group, and then he's found, you know, face down, drowned, and he was a good swimmer, you know, drowned in his pool 30 days after he was kicked out of the group.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, just, you know, if that happened today, it'd be crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, Jimi Hendrix, I actually visited, you know, where the flat that he died in London, and you know, the police get a call, you know, that some guy isn't breathing. They show up, the door's open, no one there, and he's you know, supposedly the autopsy said that he had, they tried to revive him, but supposedly, you know, he had died of asphyxiation of wine. Actually, wine vomit. It's kind of gross, but it asphyxiated him. But one of the presiding doctors found it odd that he really didn't have any alcohol in his system, but his stomach was full of red wine, and there was red wine all over his body, his shirt, his hair was matted down, and he was a former British Ranger. And, you know, he was speculating at the time that it looked kind of suspicious. It looked like he was almost waterboarded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that one looks kind of suspicious, too, just based on the evidence. But the most compelling thing for me, the thing that really got me going thinking about the story, was that three of the artists, Hendrix, Joplin, and Al Wilson, who was the founder, Blind Al Wilson, who was the founder of Canned Heat.
Right.
All were on the same billing at a concert in Berlin, and all died within 30 days of that concert. Now, all of the, and coincidentally at the same age, but all died within 30 days. Now, what would happen today? You know, we don't even hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just stumbled upon it going through. What would happen today if three of the biggest rock stars in the world all died within 30 days and all been on the same concert bill?
Right.
Well, yeah. I mean,
it's crazy, but it was just all buried. Nothing happened.
Yeah.
Let's quantify
so everything
this.
Is it
hip hop?
Oh, is it hip hop?
If it's hip hop, oh well.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the cover of the book. It's a wonderful piece of art, and there's got to be a story there.
Yeah, I wanted, against the publisher's objection, you know, they wanted an entirely different kind of cover. I wanted something that looked kind of, you know, art from the period, sort of psychedelic.
Right.
And so, I asked David Singer, who's one of the last remaining Fillmore West cover artists, poster artists, to do a couple sketchings, and he came up with one that that we both really liked, and then that one eventually developed into the cover. So, you know, David's one of, you know, you'll see his some of his posters are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and you know, he'll have some of his posters at their big Summer of Love event this year.
Uh-huh.
This summer, 50th anniversary. But and David went on part of the book tour with me to sign the book. But it is a work of art, and you know, he was very pleased with the outcome. And it's you know, it's very sort of metaphorical, if you will, and so some of the things on the cover seem to be explained after you read the book. But he's, you know, one of the last remaining Fillmore West artists. Worked for Bill Graham. Did, I don't know, you know, 7,500 posters for him, maybe more, maybe hundreds. And did some of the most famous, you know, posters that we all see, you know, today is almost museum pieces.
Yeah, it looks,
you
like
know,
it's.
So I was really lucky to get him to do that.
It looked like something that should have been on the front of a Jefferson Airplane album cover.
Oh yeah, or a rock concert.
Yeah.
That was the effect we wanted.
There's a
pretty cool.
Yeah.
There's a bust on its side. Is that Alexander the Great?
That is Alexander the Great. A lot of people think it's David. The reason it's Alexander the Great, and we turned it on its side and then decided to have some blood coming out from it. Jim Morrison, who's one of the rock stars in the book, Jim Morrison thought he was Alexander the Great reincarnated. I don't know if you knew that, but he patterned the way his sort of style, his hair, he patterned after Alexander the Great, the way he hung his head. And that's actually the bust or facsimile of the of a photo of the bus from the from Athens, you know, from
the Parthenon,
one of the museums in Athens, yeah. From the museum right at the Acropolis, the new Acropolis Museum.
Okay. And then Bright Midnight. Tell us how you came up with that title.
Yeah, that's an interesting title.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Bright Midnight is, and I'll you know, pose a question to you guys. Bright Midnight is a line in a Doors song. It was on their first album.
It has to be.
Yeah, there's. It was part of a line. The end of one line in one of the songs on the Doors' first album.
It has.
There's a song called. On their first album that Jim Morrison actually borrowed, sort of paraphrased a William Blake poem.
Yeah, End of Night.
Yeah, that's where he got it from, mm-hmm. And it. It talks about people who are you know, born to the bright midnight, and some people are born to eternal darkness. Some people are born in the bright midnight, and it's meant to be sort of like a flash in the pan.
Yeah.
And all of these stars, I thought it was appropriate. All of these stars were just bright, you know, bright objects. For a period of time,
mm-hmm. Right.
And they've been frozen in time, you know. But they were bright objects for a period of time, in an era that that was somewhat dark before them, and somewhat meteoric in their careers because they weren't around for very long.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Well, they seem to hit at exactly the right time.
Yeah.
It was a transitional time between like the Dave Clark Five. And I know other, you know, I don't have any other thing to, you know, okay, Gary Lewis and the Playboys. And then you roll into the Beatles, that started to get a little psyche in the 67 with Revolver, or 66 mm-hmm. with the Revolver album. And then you have mm-hmm. the Doors, and mm-hmm. all of a sudden the Doors hit, and everybody goes, whoa,
yeah,
what is this? And about the same time, Jefferson Airplane, and all of a sudden now we've got music that's transitioning into more of the psychedelic realm. And then you have bluesy Janis Joplin.
Mm-hmm. Well, blues are a big part of kind of underscoring everything.
Right, right. Well, yeah, it's
harmonica.
Bass and ball music.
You hear some of the harmonica being played. It's like blue. I mean, it's blues. And so that's also interesting.
Well, the Rolling Stones were a blues. Rolling Stones were a blues band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were rhythm and blues to start out, right?
Yeah.
I was never a Rolling Stones fan, so my brother
blues
was...
Blues and jazz.
Blues and jazz.
Yeah. My brother had every Rolling Stone album that was ever made.
Yeah.
Now, you had a book launch. We love to talk about, of course, the writers and the writing process. And I know that you mm-hmm. had a book launch for this at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in early December of last year.
Right.
And I think... that it was the first time the book was really launched from the Hall of Fame. Is that right?
Yeah, they've had rock stars that came in or historians that talked, either had, you know, someone that had an autobiography or someone who was writing about some historical period or some kind of music, but they've never had anyone that did that wrote a fiction. And so it was kind of unique. And so David Singer came in from San Francisco, the cover artist, and you know, we had a good time there. We did a, you know, formal event.
Yeah.
And so we're pretty pleased. So just like, you know, just like you'd that was sort of our debut, and David actually made a special poster for it. So it was like a rock. It was like the first night of a rock tour.
Very fun.
And so we did it. You know, we did a number of things. We did, we're in most major cities. We're in L.A. too, spent time in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. We did quite a bit around Cleveland and New York, and then Baltimore, Washington area, and then a lot of, we did quite a bit of radio and TV.
Any advice?
To support it, and then print interviews. Yeah.
Any advice you would give to authors that are planning book tours or even setting up book events, even in their local community? Any great lessons you learned from that experience?
I'm not sure I've learned any great lessons. We made very active use of social media. You know, if you go on, there's a Bright Midnight video. We tried to generate a lot of buzz, you know, through Twitter, mm-hmm. particularly, mm-hmm. And tried to generate. You know, there's in this day and age, you've got to use social media, you know, to generate some following and some interest. I think that some of it is just exposure. Mm-hmm. Of just getting the right kind of exposure. And I think that I can kind of, I probably declined as many as I took just because I knew that it wouldn't have much exposure.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But
sure.
I did a lot of sort of music, rock and roll, mystery types of either events, radio, TV, bloggers, interviewers, whatever it might be, or bookstores, because you know, there's a very strong, and if you like music, you'll like the book. If you like mysteries or mm-hmm. thrillers, you'll like the book. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to try to get to the right kind of audience. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting, the kind of people that would show up, you know, and they were used, particularly in San Francisco. I seem to bring out all the deadheads, and they wanted me to come by, and they wanted me to come back again and go out to Marin County. But you know, they were all, you know, some of them said, "Well, I knew this person," mm-hmm. or "I knew this person," you know. So there are a lot of old fans that came out, and surprisingly, a lot of kids. You know, that just like my kids, they love the music, but they don't know, right. They didn't know anything about the people. And, you know, one of the things early in the book, there's a little vignette, you know, a little scene where Gantry pulls out one of his old articles, and it was on the age of Aquarius. Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the reasons, and that was a sort of a heavy edited part, one of the reasons I did that is because my kids had no clue, you know, that these were enemies of the state or what was going on.
Sure.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
they just don't, they don't teach them a whole lot about that.
Sure.
And I wanted to kind of put this in the right perspective, so, you know, it was, it would make sense that they would have flimsy investigations, if at all. Many of them didn't even have autopsies,
right.
You know,
it's
and
almost
had very flimsy things. And, you know, I wanted to sort of put it in the context. You know, it was almost like, you know, you were joking before. It's almost like, you know, 10 years ago, if a bunch of gangster rappers shot each other up, you know,
yeah.
You know, the police probably wouldn't have done a whole lot to try to figure out why they died.
Right.
Nope, you're right.
You know, and the same thing here. And so it set up a very nice, you know, premise that as long as their death was consistent with what they with what at least what was reported as their lifestyle, you know, no one would be the wiser, and so they'd be perfect murders. You know, so
We have a question we ask all our writers. If you haven't listened to any of our podcasts. Since this is the writer's block, the name of the show, did you ever get writer's block when you were writing this book?
Oh, absolutely. Like every day.
And how did you dig yourself out?
Every day. Well, when I first started, one of my favorite writers is a guy named Stephen Pressfield. He writes, I actually don't read mysteries or thrillers, I read history. And he writes a lot about ancient Greek and ancient Roman warfare and the times, and he's always been one of my, you know, favorite. He used to be a screenwriter. He wrote The Legend of Bagger Vance, and then became sort of legitimate novel, sort of historical novel, historical fiction kind of writer. And but he wrote a book called that one of my kids gave me when I was starting, called, not The Art of War, it's called The War of Art. And it's maybe 100 pages long, and then he followed up with another one called Going Pro. But it was all geared toward how to approach the writing business, and you have to approach it as a business, you know, but the writing business and how you overcome all of the, you know, how you find your muse if you have one, how you overcome the blocks that will always occur. And the only thing that helped me is, you know, is the first thing that he says in the book is that, you know, writing's work. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to do it, you know, this idea of having this inspiration and it come pouring out of you, I can't find any. I interviewed about a dozen writers when I was first getting started, very successful ones. And all of them approached it at work as work. They'd all write at the same time of day. Almost all of them wrote in complete silence, except for one who was a little nutty, you know. And so it was just, you know, put one foot in front of the other and try to do it. And once you get a draft, then the real, you know, and I'm going through in my next book, the real editing process, right, which is where it really becomes a book.
Right.
You know,
right,
you've got a lot of words before. And one guy who's very successful, I told him, how do you know when it's finished? And he goes, when I can't see my mistakes anymore.
There you go.
That's a good
That's a good answer.
And so, yeah, you know, that's, you know, it's, you know, it's, if you're going to do it, you have to approach it as a professional, as you would in any other professional aspect, sure, of your life. And
sure,
so sometimes, you know, I remember when I was first doing the first, I've gotten a lot better since then, but on the first one, you know, I might work for a week and get like a paragraph because I was doing all my own research and everything else. And then other times you're in the zone and it just flows.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the first draft of Bright Midnight was 450 pages long, and by the time it was published, it was 300.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's how much was taken out. And so you've got to be, you know, you've got to be pretty dedicated to producing a good product. And, you know, I took a lot of advice from the pros, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so.
You are a very successful businessman and now a successful writer. Are there some similarities between the two?
Well, I wouldn't call myself a successful writer. I write. I'm hoping the next one is, you know, when I spend some time with a number of successful writers, they sort of warn me that there's a rite of passage here, and it usually
right,
takes
don't give up your day job
before you get some commercial success. You know, I'm hoping the second one I think is going to be a larger commercial success.
Good.
But yeah, there are. I think that they're in one very unique way. You know, this kind of writing, fiction writing, is, you know, it's highly creative and it's very difficult. It's one of the hardest things I've ever done. But it's you're telling a story. You're trying to tell it in a way that, just like you had mentioned, Bobby, you know, earlier, that it kind of drew you in and you was believable. You want to draw people in and you want them to feel empathy for you want them to believe the story, you want them to feel empathy for them, and you want them to feel some emotion. And good storytelling is a hallmark of any good leader. All good leaders create, you know, you can mechanically go through all the management processes and develop great strategies and all that, but, you know, the best leaders are those that explain it and keep explaining it in a way that, no matter whether you're, you know, the president of the company or whether you're a clerical person, you know, or someone on the assembly line, you can understand that.
Mm.
You know, and so good storytelling is the consistent between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And I found not that what I did in business was all fiction. it's I think that creative process is very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It did start intimidating people at work, especially some of our marketing people, when I'd start to look and edit some of their documents. They knew that I, you know, a little bit intimidated. They go, oh, shit. Yeah, so.
God, I wish you'd stop writing.
Yeah, stop writing.
Yeah. Jim, let's see. We need you, Chris, to tell our audience like where they can find out more about you, get the book, things like that.
Right.
Well, you can buy the book on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, you know, any of the online services or the bookstores. Or you can go to my website, chrisformant.com.
Right.
Tells you a little bit more about me and there's some excerpts of the book, and you can order the book there. And then a lot of the media, because a lot of the media support and interviews have been very interesting across the board, very non-traditional, from a, you know, almost more like a record, you know,
right,
a record tour than a book tour.
Right.
You know, so it's pretty interesting. Or you can just Google,
right,
and find out a little bit more.
We did a lot of that when we were reading your book.
Yes.
Every time that Gantry Googled, I Googled too.
I have to tell you, I have never Googled so much while reading a book in my life. And found out that
did you have background music? I'm curious. Did you have background music? Did you put any music on when you were reading it?
I finally did. I wanted to remember some things, so I can't say that I had it on the whole time, but I would be like, oh, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. I want to remember what that sounded like of Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
Or, oh, I want to hear Janis's voice. And I wouldn't play it all, yeah, all the way, but
right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I write, and I also when I edit and stuff, I play Pandora, and I've got, you know, several different channels, mm-hmm, of Pandora, mm-hmm, and depending on, mm-hmm, what I'm reading, I go to the '60s, which of course that was the Pandora I played when I was reading your book. You know, I listen to Lightfoot, I listen to all kinds of stuff. So it was you know, yes, music is a must for me. It's a total mess.
Yeah, I'll tell you, when we did the kickoff, the debut, the Rock Hall put like a set list of every song, mm, and other song, every song that was mentioned in there, and every and then songs from some of the artists. I'll tell you something. I'll pass on something that's kind of unique, because I think you and some of your listeners, you know, may and you guys write, so you'll appreciate this. When I was right before the book was released, I interviewed, I went to something called Thriller Fest, which, mm-hmm, is the annual convention of all the thriller writers, and took place about this time a year ago, and I spent some time with about 11 or 12 of some of the top mystery writers in the world. And, you know, got to know them. We actually did some film interviews,
mm-hmm,
too. They're on YouTube.
I watched a couple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that was kind of, they were each about 20 minutes long, so we clipped them way back. But one of the things that was interesting, and I asked each of them, because, you know, everybody says, oh, how do you, you know, what's your process, and blah, 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 blah. And I asked them, I said, let me ask you guys a question. And every single one said they'd never been asked this before. And I asked them a question. I said, when I'm writing, I sort of hear a rhythm. I hear music when I'm doing it. And there's kind of a syncopation to it. And every one of them said, no one's ever asked me that before, but I do. They each have their own kind of syncopation.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly, and you triggered it, you just triggered this when you said when you're editing, you do that.
Right.
And they said when they edit, they have a different one,
uh-huh,
that's much more lively when they go through, and they may put on music when they do it. But none of them, except for one, actually listened to music during the writing process.
Really?
Because they found it distracting.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they found it distracting, but they heard music.
I find
some
it relaxing.
Some of them,
yeah,
you know, some of them sort of, Peter James, who's a famous a mystery writer
yeah.
in top mystery writer in Europe hears like Bobby Darin kind of music when he's writing, and so cool. and all of them had like different kinds of things that they had. Some of them it was just like a rhythm or a syncopation, mm-hmm. but they all felt that their writing had almost a musical syncopation to it that they viscerally felt.
That's fascinating. We have
kind
a
of
new,
interest.
We
yeah,
have
it
new,
is. I've
we
never
new,
heard.
Yeah.
I, you know, I just I thought it was just me.
We
yeah,
have a,
and they said, "Oh no, no."
We have a new question we need to be asking every show now.
Yes.
Jim.
Do you listen to music? Do you hear music
yeah.
when you write? Chris, we got to go. We're going to run out of time here. Personal email address, real quick.
Pardon me.
A personal email address.
How people can reach you by email.
You can go to my website, chrisformant.com, and reach me there. Or you can just send me an email at cm as in man formant formant at aol.com.
Excellent.
Or you can go to my Twitter site. You can go to Twitter. I'm on all the social media.
Okay,
sites, and so you can get to me.
I also have a Writer's Block coffee mug coming your way. It'll be leaving probably
oh, cool.
on Saturday. It should be
I'll
from there.
It.
It'll be oh, well. I hope you do. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
it's been a
you.
Hoot having you.
Thank you.
And a great book.
Oh,
I hope it does well for you.
We look forward to the next book.
And we do.
Oh, thank you.
And we do. And have yourself a great evening, or what's left of it. And thanks again.
Okay, thank you guys.
You bet.
Really appreciate
Bye-bye.
It.
Bye-bye.
Fun. Thank you.
Bye. Bye. I want to read the next book.
Me too. Me too.
So get it published.
There you go. We have next week, we have coming up, we have Maggie Espinoza, who mm-hmm. has written a book about walking to all of the missions in California. I guess Amtrak was her chariot, and she would meet people and walk to the missions. And there's a lot of them. And she is going to be on next week. And the week after, of course, is Jeff MacArthur, mm-hmm. who is, he wrote a book called Two Gun Heart. He's working on something else right now. Jeff is always a lot of fun to be around. July 27th, or as the bookie put it, Juki 27th. Gary Phillips, who does Asian Pulp, and is a hell of a storyteller. He'll be with us probably on the phone. And we have coming up in the future, we don't have a date yet exactly, but we have a couple writers going to be on with us. First one is Bianca Marais. Her book, Hum If You Don't Know the Words, is about growing up in South Africa as a young child during the apartheid era. And that ought to be fascinating. Mm-hmm. And the next we have John Sanford, who is the writer of all the Prey novels with Lucas Davenport as the protagonist. He writes books with Virgil Flowers and has written several others that have nothing to do with either one. John Sanford is if you go into an airport and you go into a bookstore and you don't see a John Sanford book, you're in the wrong airport or probably the wrong country. Okay, again, we have Tuscany Bay's got a new book. It's called Jonah Blue. It's available now on Amazon, all the online booksellers. It's great having you with us tonight on the Writer's Block. And Chris, thank you again for giving us your time. I guess that's it for us.
We'll see you next Thursday.
Next Thursday, same bat time, same bat channel. That's us for us. That's it for us this Thursday, and we are out of here.